Succession number 21659, Wheel 5.
Tony Colgan, Reel 5.
Yes, Jim wanted a fur coat for his wife, and you could buy nylon stockings or whatever you want, and they were in great demand in England, and I used to get a few pairs for my sisters and girlfriend at home. But we all clubbed together for this fur coat, and it was quite expensive. I can't tell you any idea of how much it was now, but we all clubbed together all our money to buy it. And Bessie's still got the fur coat now, and that's 60 years later. It's a bit tatty, I believe. I haven't seen it in recent time, but it always gets a mention whenever we meet up. And we meet up once or twice a year, I suppose. I shall be seeing him on the 23rd of August this year. Yeah.
So why was it a black market? Because, after all, why shouldn't somebody sell a fur coat?
Yeah, quite, yeah. It was all bound up with accumulating sufficient money to be able to buy it, and you had to, it wasn't necessarily money, they were quite happy to take cigarettes instead, you see. And if you had a reliable source of cigarettes, like somebody sending you 200 cigarettes through the post, which was a very unreliable thing, you could go into a tobacconist in England and say, I want to send 200 cigarettes to my boyfriend and so on. So they would take your money and they would eventually get out there, but they were very unreliable and very long in coming. If you had somebody who was really enthusiastic about buying stuff out there, then of course you could have got somebody to send cigarettes out on a regular basis. I heard some people who were astute with their buying, and they accumulated the money and bought property. One or two I heard doing this, they're buying houses in Berlin or apartments in Berlin. Which I think was a damn good idea. I didn't even think about it. Yeah, but Berlin was without question the best posting we ever did.
What was the attitude of Berliners towards you?
Oh, they were quite friendly. We weren't allowed to fraternise with the Germans. It was a strict rule, and one of the things we were told, that if we were walking along the road and there was a German coming towards us, that we must not divert our direction to go round them. We must, if necessary, push them off the pavement. Don't think it ever got done. But you can't push a woman off the pavement, can you? Not really. And it's difficult not to be friendly with the children, because they always have some kind, they're always nice to have children about in those circumstances. And what we used to do was a particular child you would probably more or less adopt. And if you had, when your nappy ration came along, you would probably give them a bar of chocolate or some sweets or something like that. And it was always nice to have this kind of relationship. But no, we had no problems with them. We had problems with the Russians, though. They were always creating a bit of a fuss. But nevertheless, they would. We had all the best opera and ballet companies used to come up to Berlin. All the really best ones, like Doyle Cart and Tadler's Wells. And I went to them all. Jim and I used to drag. I don't think he was particularly interested, but old Jim was a good lad, and he used to come with us. So we saw all the best things. And there would be us two private soldiers in among a load of American, British, and French and Russian officers. And the officers, Russian officers, would wear overcoats that went down to their ankles with it wasn't hemmed off, it was like the end of a blanket, you know. And they would come along there, and occasionally they would wear swords. They weren't encouraged to wear swords there. But nevertheless, opera and ballet was absolutely first class. And then Jim and I tried to get in to see Beethoven's Fidelio, and we booked a ticket, but every time the day came along, we were on duty. So even to this day, I've never seen Fidelio.
What problems were you having with the Russians?
There was a cafe we used to frequent called the Berliner Kindle, and we used to go in there for a drink most evenings. And then one evening there was, although it was a British sector, there was a load of Americans in a line across, it was L-shaped cafe, across the, just beyond the entrance. And they would let all the Brits through, but the Russians, they were chucking out. And apparently, one of them, the Russian, had come through and was drinking rather heavily and ran out of money. So he went up to one of our tank man, a tanky waller, and he's intimated that he wanted some of his drink, and this tanky man said, bugger off. And so the Russian drew his sword. The tanky man took his sword from him and literally broke it across his knee. So how he did it, I don't know, but it literally snapped across his knee. Chucked the Russian out. So the Americans were on our side, and they didn't want any more of this kind of thing, so they made sure the Russians didn't come along. So it wasn't uncommon. I went through the Russian sector once, and I was with, I think again I was with Jim, and Jim said to me, for God's sake, don't look round, Tony. And of course I did, and there was a Russian holding a civilian up at a pestle point. So, and we were unarmed. Oh, they were an unpleasant lot. While we were up in Berlin, we had a victory parade. Marshal Zhukov was one of those who took the salute. And we had the T-34 Russian tanks all coming along the Unter den Linden from the Brandenburg Tor up through the Tiergarten, up the road, up the hill. I can't remember the name of it. One side was called the Unter den Linden, but I can't remember the other side. And it was a magnificent parade, and he was resplendent with his portly belly and his green uniform. Quite a handsome man, but obviously enjoyed his food. He was still around until some recent times, but he was one of those responsible for the capture of Berlin. I can remember the T-34s, but I can't remember any British tanks going through. No, but we had a big infantry. That's right, we had no tanks in Berlin. Yeah, so it was all purely infantry, and we did a march past about, 20 abreast, I think it was, up the through the Tiergarten. It was quite a parade. Yeah.
How did Berliners get on with the Russians?
Oh, I think they were unhappy. They didn't want to be in the Russian zone at all. They were discouraged from coming over to the West anyway. And of course there was the British sector, for some unknown reason, we got the best bit of Berlin, where it all went on with the opera house and all the cinemas and virtually the West End of Berlin, or what, you know, we think of about the West End. There was the British sector, French sector, American and Russian, yes, and we without doubt had the best bit. I don't know why we got it, because it's usually the Americans who get the best bit, or the Russians. Yeah. And the French were, he didn't, I often come across French troops. I think one of the things I resent most of all is about de Gaulle, who walked into France and virtually took it over, as if to say, well, look what I've done. And he never, ever once said, thank you. Not once. And I think all the British agents who were in France at the time were virtually chucked out, you know, by him. And then, of course, there came the period of occupation. And once we left Berlin, we went down to near Bad Oeynhausen, I seem to remember. We were quite well. I think Germans accepted the fact they were there and there wasn't anything they can do about it. And then there was the fear of being going to the Far East, because you're no good as soldiers in occupied territory. And we used to, by that which time I'd become the company clerk, because they couldn't find anybody else to do it. And I used to send up a weekly Far East return, which denoted all those who were eligible to go to the Far East. Some were almost ready, up to a certain demobment number, were not eligible, and the rest virtually were. And we used to send a Far East return to battalion headquarters once a week. Yeah. People used to come up and say, "Am I on that Far East return?" And they'd say, "Yeah, afraid you are, you know." And poor bloke would worry, because nobody wanted to go out to Burma and the Far East. It was too far from home. But anyway, yeah, it was only a matter of a month or two, and they dropped the atom bomb, and that was the end of the war as far as we were concerned. Can I go back on anything?
Could I ask you about the time when you're in the East Riding, because you're in the East Riding of Yorkshire with 9th DLI?
No, I was with the 10th Battalion, the Buffs, then, those days. It was in a training regiment. Once I went into the Buffs in Canterbury, we went then from Canterbury to Devon, Newton Abbot, Denbury Camp, Newton Abbot, that's right. And then we went from there to just outside Hull. Honestly, memory. Just outside Hull, where we stayed for a short while, training. Yes. I remember falling out of a three-tier bunk one day, but yes, we did some field firing in a rather handsome valley. A very close little valley with a machine, with a farmhouse halfway along. The farmhouse was a wreck anyway, and I was detailed off to fire a Bren gun, and I had a whole box of magazines, and I fired at this farmhouse. And talk about wanton destruction! I knocked all the chimney pots off, and I got all the windows out, and I was starting on the back door. I had to change barrels twice, I think, because it was getting red hot. But it was the most fun I ever had with a Bren gun.
Why did that girl in Beauvais give you the lock of hair with the tricolour?
Beauvais itself, a small provincial town. We've stayed in. We were put up. We camped in a sort of square. And the middle of it was green, and there were civilians in the houses, and one of the young ladies there was pregnant. And I'm going back quite a few days before the girl presented me with the lock of hair. And she was pregnant by a German soldier, and they used to cut your hair off if you were a woman who'd been having anything to do with women. And we didn't like this idea at all, so we wanted to prevent her having her hair cut off, but we were ordered not to interfere. It was nothing to do with us, and they did, literally took her away and cut her hair off. Wasn't the first time I saw hair cut off. We went down in, and we moved then on into Beauvais, along a lane that led to a house. And we were just staying there waiting to move on. And people used to come round and talk to you. And this young lady was a nurse, and she spoke English. And she was talking about Beauvais and her life and where she'd been in hospital, where she worked in the hospital. And so I don't know whether I asked for a lock of her hair, but she did cut her lock off, and then she had a little tricolour which was gathered as a to look like a bow, and she took that off and put it in there, folded it up, and gave it to me, and I kept it for years afterwards. Yeah, but for no other reason, just than that we were. She was pleased to see British troops, and that the period of occupation was over. Going along through France, anyway, as you were going, and often our advances were 50 or 60 miles in one day, there would always be crowds of people cheering you and offering you apples or whatever they had, you know, available. It was a great relief to them, yes, I've no doubt. Mm.
Can you tell me anything about feeding in the field, and in particular about burgoo?
Burgoo, yeah, burgoo. Burgoo was, we used to get what they called hardtack biscuits. And although some, there used to be a variety of them. One variety was just hard and unpleasant. Some were slightly sweet. But what we used to do was get half a dozen or so biscuits and put them in a tea towel, and then smash them with a hammer till they became powder. Then you'd put them in a mess tin and add, well, we didn't have much milk, but add milk and sugar to it, and that would make a porridge. So it made a change of diet. Once you got into a carrier, you had to do your own cooking. There was no such thing as messing with the company. You had to cook for yourself, because you were never anywhere near a company. Only when you came out in reserve did you ever... come out on rest, and that was when you were way behind the line. Did you feed as a company where somebody else would do your cooking? We never liked it, because we'd rather cook for ourselves. We went through all sorts of things. We made a field oven in Normandy, actually. We dug a hole in the ground and put an ammunition box on top. And we put a mortar case, a single mortar case, behind the ammunition box, covered it with earth, and lit a fire underneath. And the tube from the ammunition, from the mortar around, we acted as a chimney, and we used to use it as an oven. And we used to make some quite pleasant things, like baked jam rolls and some simple form of cakes, because occasionally you would get currants or something like that, something unusual, and you'd make a cake with it. We had all sorts of people with us. We had one chap who was a butcher, so if we needed, because we used to feed in the field a lot, or feed from from whatever was available. So you dig your own potatoes. If there were peas or something like that, you'd pick those. If you needed meat, there was always a dead cow or something like that, or one that had just been killed. And if there wasn't, well, you could always go to a pigsty and kill one, because we had the wherewithal to kill. And on one occasion, we set an ambush, because we suspected the Germans were coming through our lines and in a particular place. We set the ambush, put along trip flares, and just waited, and there was machine guns, there were Sten guns, there were rifles, every kind of small arm weapon you could think of, waiting to blow this trap. And it went off, and all hell broke loose, machine guns and everything. And it was a poor old cow that had made the flares go off. So, not wishing to waste the meat, we cut it up, and we're... I think a forequarter went up to company headquarters, and a hindquarter went up to battalion headquarters, and so on, you know. So everybody got a fair share, and we all had steak for dinner and things like that. Same place, and this was in Holland, actually, same place. And the poor old civilians had left a milk cow behind in the shed. So old Jim's, it's a shame, you know, this, because it'll be in agony if we don't milk it. So old Jim used to milk it. And away you go, milking the cow. And then we'd have to feed it and that kind of thing. And then the guards took over from us on that particular place. And we handed over the cow to them. So they were then milking it. And then we took over from them again. And then we got our own cow back. And we were milking the cow. So we had... it was bitterly cold winter, as you know. And what we used to do with the farmhouse, we used to keep the fire going in the farmhouse. And we'd have a pan of milk on. And just before you came off stag, you would have a pan, and you put a drop of rum in, a liberal drop of rum, and have a good glass of milk and rum just to warm you up. You needed it to, and it was an absolute lifesaver. Food, it stood me in good stead over the years, because when I got married, my wife couldn't cook, couldn't boil a kettle. And for the first 2 years of married life, I did all the cooking, you know, roast beef and whatever you say. Until one day she said, you know, that's my job, really. So, and I didn't then cook until after she died. So she passed on. But even so, it was a job remembering how to make pastry and things like that. But army life did keep me in, it stand me in good stead in the, as far as cook's concerned. I now bake a cake for my grandson, who's 13 years old, and if I go up there and I haven't got a cake, he's quite disappointed, yeah. Apple pies I make, and I generally cook, and it's only because the army taught you how to do it, you know.
How do you feel now about having served with the DLI in the Second World War?
Then I would have done anything to get out of it, but now I, looking back, it was an experience which, let's face it, it's full of interest and memories, and the fact that people like you want to know what we did, how we got on. It's an experience which you, as you had to experience it, you wouldn't have wanted to miss it. Has lots of spin-offs now. We went over to Holland in May, and I organised this trip, and about 38 of us, I think it were, I organised the trip, and I usually do a little booklet to go with it, so that they know exactly where they're going, what they've got to do, what they must not do. You know, like, you're not allowed to smoke in the coach, you mustn't drink on the coach, and things like that. So I give them a few don'ts, but a lot of do's as well. Don't forget your passport, or whatever you do, and so on. And one of the, they write to me and say, well, could we go to so-and-so? And one of them, we were staying at Veldhoven, just outside Eindhoven. One of the chaps said to me, can't we go to Utrecht? Because the Polar Bear Division went to Utrecht, and there is a monument I would like to see. So I said, there's not a chance, really. I've got it all organised, and I don't really want to change anything. And then I thought, well, that's what it's all about. So I got the name of a woman in Utrecht called Mrs. Kortenhof Nepperus. Hell of a handful of a name. And she's a chairman of some kind of committee, whether it's to do with a market garden, or whether she's the chairman of the committee of the council, I don't know. But she's a very influential person, and she said, we'd be pleased to see you. So we went to Utrecht, and she phoned the day before to our driver and said, do you know how to get there? And he said, well, no, not really. And he said, this is a bit complicated. And even though we'd had the maps, I don't think we'd ever got there. She said, right, pull into the service station just before Utrecht, and we'll meet you there. And we did. And as we pulled in, there was a police car in front of us, and it led us all the way through Utrecht. And talk about, they're no different to us in Holland. They'd come tearing past our coach, suddenly see a police car, and then pull in, you know. And then you could see one of them was thinking, what's all this about? You know, he's not going all that fast, and so on. And then they'd suddenly realize, ah, there's a coach behind, he's an escort. And then they'd pull out, and away they go, you know, knowing they were safe. But We went to Utrecht, and they were waiting for us. She was a quite handsome, slender, older woman, I suppose, plus a committee. And they took us to where this polar bear was. It was, well, not a large monument, but it was very attractively done. And we had a little service and a parade there and laid a wreath and so on. And one of our chaps in Market Garden, Bob Raybould, is forever writing poems about all sorts of things. I shall show it to you in a minute. And he wrote a poem about the Dutch and Utrecht. And he read it out to the assembled company. And it was quite good, actually, because, you know, some poets, they're quite interested in composing poetry, but they're not much good at it. But anyway, Bob's not bad. And she was so taken with this poem, she said, could I have a copy of it? Now, it's taken about 3 months to get it off the ground. But yesterday I was given the poem framed with photographs of us all in Utrecht, which I've got to send off tomorrow. Yeah. So, but I'll show you the poem. But the Dutch don't ever forget, and their welcoming is always, you know, more than you'd expect. There was foot and mouth disease got over to Holland, so. One of the plays is a play called Wageningen. Whether that's the right pronunciation, I don't know. Wageningen, W-A-G-G-E-N, Wageningen, I think it is. And they have a big parade, and Prince Bernhard usually attends the parade, so it is something big to get to the royal family involved there. And you can never, ever finish the parade because people are just grabbing your arm and taking you off. And it is a fantastic kind of appreciation. And that was cancelled this year because of foot and mouth. So they said, well, Rene, I can't remember his surname, said, well, we can't disappoint you. So we've arranged a little afternoon do in a windmill. And it was a windmill that's been rebuilt, I suppose. And it actually does still grind corn. And in this village, there's also a little private museum, which was an absolute gem. And we had lunch there and all the drink, you know, that you could drink forever in Holland, if you like, once they know who you are. The museum was the ground floor of a house and the upstairs, and it was absolutely chock-a-block with memorabilia from the war. We had lunch and they took us over the mill. Koos, the miller was named Koos, K-O-O-S, and he couldn't speak English. He apologised because he said he could once upon a time speak English because he'd had an accident and it affected his memory. So his memory of English had actually gone. So, but we had lots of other people who were quite happy to translate. We went all over the mill, saw exactly how it worked, and it seemed the most dangerous place to me. But anyway, it does work, and they even got the sails going round for us, and they go round a heck of a rate, and if you got in the way of them, it really hurts you. Yeah.